I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Richard Spencer of the National Policy Institute and Washington Summit Publishers. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Greg.
Well, Richard, on Christmas Day, you launched a new webzine, Radix. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Radix is the webzine Radix, which is radixjournal.com, is an attempt to do a couple of different things because the term Radix I use as the cultural component to everything that we do at MPI. So that MPI itself focuses on politics, and Washington Summit Publishers proper focuses on science and proper understanding of human biodiversity. And Radix is really our way of talking about culture, thinking about society, thinking about tradition, and trying to revive distinctly Occidental ways of looking at the world. And we already have an imprint of WSP that is called Radix, and we've actually published, under that imprint, we've published a couple of novels, one that has just been released by Tito Perdue, and another very good novel by Derek Turner called Sea Changes, which we released. And we also have Radix Journal, which is kind of a new take on the journal, I think. And I think it's a kind of post-web take on the journal. And that is that we want to do, we don't think that print is going to die. We think that print will cease to be the medium of communications, of course, the primary medium. But it's still going to be around. And so print can offer us this opportunity to experiment aesthetically. It can offer us an opportunity to get away from just blogging or tweeting or Instagram photos or whatever, and to really write something that we want to last for a long time. And my idea for Radix was that each journal would have a theme to the extent that it would be a kind of monograph. So, you know, the first one was The Great Erasure, the deconstruction or the reconstruction of white identity. And the second one, which is almost done, it's called Pop Fascism, which is a kind of play on a great term that Jonathan Bowden came up with, as you know, called pulp fascism. And I would say it's interesting right-wing traditionalist takes on pop culture, you know, going from Watchmen, which you're writing on, to James Bond, to Superman and Batman and stuff like that. So, and I think we're kind of creating monographs that will hopefully have a long shelf life so that someone would go to, you know, Amazon or, you know, iBooks or something and see this maybe 5 or 10 years from now and still find that this is worthwhile. And this is something you would want to keep on your shelf. So that is the basic idea of Radix Journal. And in many ways, though I am very excited about Radix Journal, in many ways I've failed in my effort to keep it timely. It's with all of my commitments, it seems like I'm always just really slow and we're a year behind and it's terrible. And I think one reason for that was that we didn't really have this dynamic web component where people would come and they'd want to contribute, people would want to read, maybe even read articles in progress. There'd be some blogging. There'd be a real robust web aspect to Radix. And so I wanted to create that. And I also wanted to work with someone who's really been a friend and colleague since we've really gotten into become friends over the past year, and that is Romain Bernard, who is actually stationed in mm-hmm. France. And so anyway, we're going to have radixjournal.com as a webzine, and we want this webzine to be a launching pad for Radix Journal, the print edition. And so my idea really is for to have original content, a lot of it produced by Romain and myself, but also produced by others, and that we would also request an article from someone like yourself or like, you know, many of the other great people we know, and that they would write an article for the web zine, and it would go up, and they would get some feedback, and they'd meditate on the piece for a little bit. And then later on, they'd come back to it, maybe 6 months or even a year later, and they would rewrite it and expand it and really turn it into, and maybe also add some scholarly components to it, like footnotes and so on and so forth. And they would really turn it into something lasting. And I like this process, and I think this process is going to generate very good material. And so that is the basic, that is the kind of, artistic motivation for it all. I would say that my own personal motivation is that over the past year and a half, since I stopped blogging at alternativeright.com in the spring of 2012, in many ways, I've enjoyed the rest from blogging. I mean, I edited Alternative Right for 2 years. I edited Talkie Mag for 2 years. And so for about 4 years, I was blogging nonstop, more or less every day. And I really loved the respite I had from that. But I also had this very strong itch to get back into it. And so, personally speaking, I think Radix Journal is going to be my chance to express myself again online and to really get back in the fray. So those are the two motivations I would say we have.
Well, you don't need to apologize to me for having trouble getting print periodicals out, because I know firsthand the difficulty of that. North mm-hmm. American New Right Volume 1 took a year and a half to bring out. North American New Right Volume 2 is going to come out about 2 years after the first North American New Right. It's very mm-hmm. difficult to work with a lot of people,
yeah.
to herd a lot of authors together, to get them to look at their work in a timely fashion, to do revisions, to look at proofs, and on and on and on. And when you're juggling a lot of other things, it can become something that drags on and on. Another mm-hmm. thing is that I'm a big believer in quality and a bit of a perfectionist. And having artificial deadlines, if it gets in the way of doing the best possible job, I would just assume set the deadline aside and make sure that it comes out perfect. So anyway, I do think that it's very common and very reasonable. Also, a lot of periodicals in, say, scholarly discipline, it's very, very easy to keep those things coming out periodically, because there's a huge press of mainstream scholars trying to get their material out in the whole publisher yeah. parish academia. But for us, we have to beat the bushes to find good material. And sometimes it just takes more time.
Absolutely true. I mean, I agree with everything you said, basically, in terms of deadlines and also in terms of the need for quality. And also the need to iterate, I think, is another thing that I might add on that. I'm very proud with The Great Erasure, and I think all of the pieces I think are great, and I think all of them offer an interesting perspective on the world. But I want to get better, and I actually learned a lot of things in terms of producing that I want to bring to the next one and the next one. And so I think there has to be a balance, and this balance is very hard to find between perfection and then also between iteration, and that is making mistakes, learning from them, reassessing, getting better, learning what works, what doesn't, and so on and so forth. So we need to find that balance, and it's difficult, but but if you care about your work, you will find it. If we wanted to make a quick buck off a book or something like that, there are certainly ways of doing that. There's someone you might know who seems to publish books of very low quality, and it's almost as if he's tricking his buyers into buying them. And I don't want to ever be like that. I want people to look back 10 years from now and be like, oh, wow, you can see a whole journey in this publishing cycle. Like they kept getting more radical. They kept getting better. They kept getting aesthetically more interesting and daring. And that's really what that's what I want the experience for the reader to be, is, what are they going to do next kind of thing. And I don't want them to purchase something and be like, oh, wow, well, there goes $25, kind of thing. So that's just, what it's about. I we're on this world once, and I think a book is a kind of nice way to leave a mark as well. And it really should be something serious and something that, our grandchildren can pick up and say, wow, my daddy is crazy.
I came from this. Well, I want to talk a bit about the interplay between web publishing and print publishing. I don't think that print is going to die either. I think that certain things, especially if they're long and complex and have careful arguments, really need to be on paper. It just gets too tiring to read really substantial essays online, and that's why I tend to break longer pieces up when I publish them at Countercurrents. But they still really need the printed page, I think, to as their proper medium to be appreciated, because it takes a little bit of reflections and rereading and note-taking and things like that. And so that's why I wanted to do North American New Right as a journal that would anthologize the best of the things we put on the web, and also the things that are most involved and detailed and really require the printed page. I think that by the same token, though, if something is worth publishing for me, it's worth publishing right away. Therefore, I wanted to be able to get things up on the web as soon as they're well edited and well written, but get them out there. And then 6 months or a year later or whenever, you can put them out at the end of a long production cycle with a print publication. But we're trying to change the world, and we don't have time to waste. And so if you think an article can contribute to changing the world, it just doesn't make any sense to sit on it for 6 months.
Absolutely. I just think we need a realistic conception of the world in which we live. And that is one in which paper is no longer the primary means of communication. That is clearly going to be done through the web, through blogs, essentially through the tubes of the internet. But I think we also need to understand that print has a place. And there are certain things that should be in print, and there are certain things that really need to be a blog or even a tweet. So I just think we need to have a realistic conception of everything. And I think a lot of people sometimes don't have that. They either dismiss print unfairly and unwisely, or they want to put things into print that really would be much better as a blog or an ebook or something like that. So I just think these are, you know, we live in a very interesting time. And I think I made this, I used this metaphor when I was doing a podcast with Romain and Jack Donovan, and I'll just repeat it here. You know, a lot of people have this horse and buggy notion of publishing, where they think, oh, well, the internet is the car and books are the horse and buggy, and the horse and buggy is outmoded and gone. And if you ride a horse and buggy, you're some weird reactionary or something like that. And that holds certainly a kernel of truth. But remember, the horse has not gone away. We now have racehorses. We now use eugenics to create beautiful, amazing horses that never existed in the past. And I think that's the proper stance we should take to print media. It's no longer going to be the way that we're going to communicate. I don't know the last time I wrote a letter outside of a Christmas card. But at the same time, we need to create a racehorse. You know, it's not going to be it's not going to be the way we reach people, but it is something that's a prestige thing. That's kind of how I think we should conceive this world we live in. And we certainly live in a really fascinating time in which all of these established forms of media are being disrupted.
Yeah, I agree. I do not think that print publishing is the equivalent of the Amish horse-drawn carriage. So I think it's going to be around. And the other thing is that we're all hoping that someday the lights go out, the internet is unplugged, that the world is reset, and all this ephemeral stuff at Gawker is just going to be gone.
Yeah.
That we want to leave things behind in permanent printed form, or relatively permanent printed form. And if they look good, the people will be burning the Danielle Steele novels for fuel and holding on to our rare and attractive looking books. I think that's something that we have to think in terms of. We are not banking that this current system is going to survive, and we think that there's probably going to be a big reset before something better comes along.
Absolutely. And I agree with that. We published a book by Piero San Giorgio called Survive the Economic Collapse. And it's actually about this, this notion of A, the total unsustainability of the current paradigm, and also how you can rebuild a community that might certainly won't have the bells and whistles we're all used to of getting Thai food at 2 a.m. and tweeting off your iPhone or whatever, but it will actually be much more rewarding and much more healthy and much more real. And I would also add to that notion is that there's a certain irony to the web. And I think people have really felt that this past year, 2013, which is in a way the year of the NSA and the year of Edward Snowden. And that is that it is very, very true that the web is free and open to a very large degree. You can go on Facebook and you can write anything from something that's wise or something that's meaningless or something that's utterly stupid. But so the web is open and free. But at the same time, authority figures could shut down Countercurrents or RadixJournal.com or your Facebook profile in a matter of minutes. And they can, without question, do that. They can contact Facebook. They could contact the hosting company. They could contact the URL provider. They could do all sorts of things. And so in a way, the web is both open and free, and the web is very strictly controlled by the current powers that be in the world. And print is not really. Once we've printed these things, they're out there. And people can display them on their shelves, or they can hide them somewhere, or they can pass them around. Like, what is that famous Russian word for dissident publication?
Samizdat.
Samizdat, exactly. So I think we, you know, in a way, there might be a great benefit to going back in time a little bit in terms of technology. Let me throw this in. Let me throw this in real quick. I reminded in the latest James Bond film, Skyfall, I think there was a kind of allegory of this where James Bond was battling a master hacker who could kind of do anything with the internet. And so the way to kill him was to take him back in time in terms of technology. So they got away from the high-tech world, and they went back to his Scottish ancestral home where he could fight him with rifles and knives as opposed to the internet. And I thought that was kind of an interesting touch to the film, and I think it's maybe a bit of a metaphor for what we might need to do.
I think that's a great metaphor. Well, every birth also requires a certain death, and the birth of Radix Journal entailed the death of Alternative Right, and there's been a little bit of thrashing about. It has not gone quietly into the night, and so if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a few questions about that.
Sure.
So let me just get this straight, okay? At a certain point, you, as editor of Alternative Right, resigned and said, I'm going to do other things. And then some of the people who had administrative privileges at Alternative Right, and I'm thinking of Colin Liddell and Andy Nowicki, continued posting there. And after a while, there was more and more activity at Alternative Right. I started going there on a daily basis again. And they were calling themselves the co-editors of Alternative Right and so forth. What was the status of that? How did that happen?
It was all very ambiguous, and that was completely my fault. And I've learned an important lesson. I mean, essentially, I would tell the story that way. I took on a lot of different things doing MPI and Washington Summit Publishers, and I've now found people who can help me. There's someone very important who is helping me with books. And there's also Romain who's helping me with doing more blogging. But at the time, I didn't have those helpers. And I was essentially overwhelmed. And so I felt that something had to go. And I also was in a mood that I felt that alt-right had done it. Alt-right had really accomplished everything that I set out to accomplish. And that was when I created alt-right back in 2010. I think it went live on March 1st, 2010. And I really, the fact that we called it Alternative Right was, had kind of two aspects to it. One of them was that I wanted to create a big tent of a lot of different people. And those people might not agree on everything, but they all were, in a sense, against the current liberal order. And I still think that's a good idea. I don't think we should be doctrinaire pagans or doctrinaire Catholics or doctrinaire whatever. I actually think we should be liberal, you know, so to speak, in the sense of we should have a big tent for our movement. And that was one aspect. Another aspect is that I really wanted to just break away from the conservative movement and give the conservative movement in a way a big F you and say, we don't like you. We don't operate under your assumptions. We are not interested in electing Republicans. We are going off into in a new direction. And I felt that alternative right conveyed that. And I felt that we did that. And I felt that also that the alt-right sphere, which is still a pretty good word, actually, a pretty good term for describing what's going on, has multiplied, and it's kind of everywhere. You see this in HVD, you see this in the so-called dark enlightenment, you see this to a certain degree in the so-called reactionary sphere, although I'm not a huge fan of that. You see this in the manosphere, you see this in all these other, you know, interesting, lively threads that are out there. And I felt that we had kind of done it, and I really wanted to move to something more substantial, more focused, that we didn't have to just say we're the alternative, you know, the alternative to what? It's a kind of negative identity. And I really wanted to have a more positive identity. And so basically I wrote a farewell address for alt-right back in the spring of 2012. And Andy and Colin had been frequent contributors, and they were still contributing, and I felt that they were putting so much energy into the project that they, in some ways, deserve to be editors. And I think that that was not a good choice, and I actually don't say that with any ill will towards either of those people. I in a way, don't think that they're best suited to be editors. And I think in some ways, particularly in sense of Colin and to a degree in sense of Andy, and again, I'm criticizing them in a constructive manner. I'm really not lashing out at anyone. I think in some ways being the editor and having that ability to just hit post and it's up there might have actually brought out the worst in them. And I think you can definitely see that with Colin. When Colin sits down and writes something and he rewrites it and he rethinks it, I think Colin can produce brilliant stuff. But I'm afraid that he's, in a way, such a talented journalist because he's an English language journalist in Japan. He writes all the time. That he has this ability to write an article in 30 minutes or something like that, something that I can't do, by the way. I'm very slow. He can do that, and I feel that he kind of shoots from the hip. And I was in this ambiguous, myself, I was in this ambiguous position where, as the founder of alt-right, it was still always associated with me. And so you can see this, I think, most vividly with the Rachel Maddow attack piece on me, where they play a video of mine, and I would that I made with a friend of mine, and I would fully endorse everything I said in that video, obviously. But then they connected me with alt-right without mentioning any of this history, and they just kind of associated me with a piece that Colin wrote. And, you know, though I don't disagree with the argument Colin made, I feel that his opener and the images that he posted was just so outlandish and offensive that I really couldn't defend it. It's not my style. It's not something that I would publish. And so I didn't like the fact that I was being associated with it. And being the fact that also that I've put myself out there by holding conferences and saying, you know, being the public face of something and saying, yes, you know, I'm not using a pseudonym. This is me. I believe this. That there were more consequences on me. And not on Colin, who is ensconced in Japan and kind of buffered from this. So I just think it was actually a bad situation, and it was also an ambiguous situation that was actually, as I say, entirely my fault, where I more or less resigned, but then I still owned the URL, and you know, I was still obviously directly associated with it. I spoke to people just before Christmas, and they would be like, oh, you must be busy editing alt-right every day. And I would be like, no. And so I just felt like I really had to make a move. I had talked with Colin and Andy back in 2012 at the end of the year, but I kind of wanted to change things. I wanted to change the name. I wanted to move on, and they didn't like that. Then I talked to them again this year, and there was a kind of sense of, oh, no, we don't want to change it. We want to keep it going. And I just got to the point where I just felt like alt-right really should have ended 2 years ago. Or a year and a half ago. I just felt like it did something. It accomplished something. It was interesting. It was a candle that burned and maybe burned itself out. But I feel like it would be better to kind of end it there. And people could look back on it as a moment in time of this was a really interesting point. And you know, Alternative Right came out before Countercurrents was launched. And I think in many ways, Alternative Right was an inspiration for you to create Countercurrents. So I think it opened up a lot of doors. It was a really great moment in time. And I just think that moment is over. And, you know, since I ultimately own it, I wanted to end it. And I did that. And whenever you do that, that can create enemies and can ruffle feathers. But that's really it. I just felt like I had to make that tough decision to end something. And it really wasn't it wasn't anything personal against Colin or Andy. But as I expressed, I like both of those men and I like both of their writing. It didn't fit. It didn't make sense. And I think it detracted what I was trying to do. And again, this might sound like selfish decision, or it might sound like a ruthless decision, or you could spin it however way you want, but I just felt like I had to make it. And, you know, if you look at a lot of corporations, when they don't kill that product that doesn't work and that doesn't make sense, it can haunt them. And I think Alternative Right did haunt me. It haunted me in 2013. It was brought up, it was used against me in ways that I didn't like and that I couldn't defend. And so, you know, I just had to make that decision. And it was very tough, but that, you know, there it is. And I just feel like we now have something with the MPI family that's very clear to people. So MPI is about offering alternative political solutions that would benefit European Americans and Europeans around the world. Washington Summit Publishers is a publishing wing, and the WSP is really associated with science, about the history of science, about human biodiversity, and so on and so forth. And Radix is about culture. So we have those three things that are very clear to people. There's politics, science, culture. And it now makes sense, and it's simple. And I like that. So I don't regret this decision that I made, even though I, without question, ruffled some feathers.
Well, I understand where you're coming from on this. I wouldn't say that Alternative Right was the inspiration for Countercurrents, because Countercurrents was really my continuation of the Occidental Quarterly online.
Yeah.
And basically, I made Countercurrents into what I wanted to make the Occidental Quarterly online into. And yet at the same time, I have to give you credit for the fact that when you came online not long before I had to get a new job, I had to create a new job for myself.
Yeah.
I really admired you bringing Steve McNallan and Jack Donovan in.
Yeah.
That was the kind of thing that if I tried to bring them on the Occidental Quarterly online or something, I would have gotten no end of squawking over. And I just sort of said, you know, I said to myself, Richard, that's a gutsy move. It's the kind of thing that I wanted to be doing. And so, you know, it's great not having to answer to a board of directors or anybody, any one person holding the purse strings. And so, you know, I've been pretty much charting a course that I would have liked to have charted way back when I started Occidental Quarterly Online. But here's the thing. I totally understand the psychology that you're going through, because after I left TOQ, there was a redesigned TOQ online that came up, and I had this weird feeling toward it. It was like having a pretender to the thrones out there circulating around in the world, you know?
Yeah.
And thank God they did practically nothing with it, because if they did, and if it was stuff that embarrassed me or I'd make me roll my eyes, I know that I'd be feeling that people who aren't paying attention would be thinking that this is Greg Johnson at work.
Mm-hmm.
You get a strong personal identification with a project, and even when you've stepped away from it, that brand sticks with you. And you know, if somebody is out there with your credit card spending your money without your authorization, you cancel the card. I mean, that's just a no-brainer. And in a way, if somebody's out there with your reputation and your credibility, in a way spending it,
yeah,
because they're editing away independently of you in a vehicle that you've created and that is inextricably associated with you, it bugs you. I know it would bug me, and I can totally mm-hmm. understand why it would bug you. And I think that, yeah, it would probably have been best if you just had said, okay, guys, 2012, boom, we're mothballing this. There are mm-hmm. a lot of other websites out there. You know, you can access all of your stuff through the archive, and I wish you all the best and go forward. That probably would have been best, because what's going on, I think, psychologically with Colin and Andy is that even though in a legal sense you own the website still, the URL and everything, they sort of have this sense that, well, that's just mine and thine. That's just legal. We have some sweat equity in this thing now. Yeah. They have a proprietary feeling because they put a lot of themselves into it. And so I can see why they're sort of frazzled and feel betrayed. And they're claiming, of course, that you did not communicate to them your intentions. Maybe they just didn't take it seriously. Or maybe they just didn't take seriously the fact that in the end, there is this mine and thine thing that you can appeal to, that you did own it. And it was yours to stop.
Yeah. I won't go into backroom dealings, but I made this clear. And I also, in a way, wish they would have followed a little more assiduously, because, you know, I created these things. You know, I've created things that have made sense, that have also benefited a lot of other people. You know, alternative right benefited a lot of other people. A lot of people got to have a voice through that. And so I just wish people would actually follow me in the sense that I have the vision to do these things, and that I will make sure that they're done right. I will create I hate to say this because it sounds almost, you know, mercantile or something, but I will create a product that is going to benefit all of us, and that will be a venue that we can all write at. I mean, again, I'm really not, I'm not against Colin, despite the fact that he's written truly ridiculous things on Facebook. And I think he wrote another post, which I haven't even read, in which I'm compared to Nick Griffin, which I guess is, I don't know. I don't even know what to say about that. Or I'm a dictator, D-I-C-K-T-A-T-O-R. I actually kind of like that, maybe.
So, yeah, next is going to be Tricky Dick Spencer. I mean, he's right. He's got a million of them. He's a wit. You know, Colin, I think, is a surprisingly talented guy. My first real interaction with him was when he was being, I think, a bit of a dick around April 20th of last year, and we sort of went into a lot of stuff. But I have to say that. And that's really when I first noticed him, honestly. I hadn't read his stuff before that. But then I read a few things by him that were really good. The recent piece that he put online about Judge Dredd, I thought, was just excellent. I thought the piece he wrote about the vacuity of Nelson Mandela was really well put, and it was an angle that it didn't even occur to me. So, and I've read a few other things by him that I thought were really well done. And so I've just, you know, a bit of a dick myself. I just swooped in after this and I said, you know, Colin, if you want to write for Countercurrents, I'll even pay you for it. I said the same thing with Andy. And part of that was just self-interest. And part of that was that I just didn't want these guys, because I could all, the shooting had already started, right? And it's like, gee, here, why don't you review this book rather than aim your jibes at Richard Spencer? Because I do have this silly notion, this utopian notion, that we might find a way of organizing this movement, this thing of ours, so that we all kind of get along, and that when we don't get along, we just make like an amoeba and split and form new little centers and spend most of our time engaging the culture, engaging the enemy, and not firing at one another.
Oh, yeah. I mean, believe it or not, I mean, I've always liked Andy's writing. I mean, I promoted Andy. He did a big thing where MPI actually paid for him to go to South Africa and write a report on the Oranje community, which is a white community in South Africa. And I've liked Colin's stuff. So, you know, again, I'm really, believe it or not, I don't have any anger towards them, and I would actually be happy to work with them again. I just think Andy seems to be more reasonable. I just think Colin, in a way, needs to kind of purge his bad emotions and you know, get over those. But I would certainly be willing to work with him again. Again, I just think he needs an editor in a way, because I think he has this talent to write quickly. And I even know this myself, because when I was at Talkie Mag and to a lesser degree at Alt-Right, I would try to get something out there. And I've always been happy with my pieces, rereading them later, the pieces that I spent a week on or even just a couple of days on, and maybe even pieces that I started and then came back to a month later and really finished it up. I always look back on those pieces and I like them. I might have critiques of them, but I still like them and I'm proud of them. There are some pieces that I've written out there that I would write essentially shooting from the hip, that I'd write quickly, and I find them either useless, a waste of time, or terrible. And so I know this, I know this feeling, and I think Colin in a way just shoots from the hip and is motivated by emotion. But it's really better when he takes a step back and has someone else edit him and things like that. And I don't mean to say that to be condescending or patronizing. I just simply think that it is a fact. And so, but again, just to sum up, I had to make a tough decision. And, you know, sometimes you have to fire people and sometimes you have to kill a product. But you just have to, you know, you have to be willing to do that. And it really is not, you know, it's not about, it's not about attacking someone personally or saying that someone doesn't have value, because both of those people do have value.
Well, yeah, I would agree they both have value. And I've published 3 books now by Andy Nowicki.
Right.
I think very highly of his work, and I hope that he will be writing more for Countercurrents after this. And so I just think that the mature way of handling this kind of stuff is to try and find ways of avoiding having fights amongst ourselves, and instead try and find ways that we can use these changes of platforms and personnel and things like that to strengthen the cause ultimately. I think that's the direction I hope everything moves in. I'd like to ask you, so if you can tell me, who are some of the other people who are writing for the next issue of Radix? I'm really curious about it.
Well, there's this one person named Greg Johnson who's excessively late.
Yeah, I know. I'm excessively late, yes. But I'm going to make it worth your while, Richard. I promise. So.
Yeah, it's on Pop Fascism. I actually do want to publish. I signed a contract with Colin Liddell through email to publish and pay for his piece on Judge Dredd, which he unwisely put online. But I will publish that, and I will pay him for it as well, since I told him that I would do that.
Well, you know, it's a great teaser for that issue.
I mean, if people
read that piece and they know that there are other pieces like that in there, then he's providing you with some advertising. And I think that that's just that's a happy way of looking at the whole thing. I'm certainly definitely excited to see more material like that. So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So you'll be in there. I'm going to have actually two pieces. We have another piece that originated. I've been ripping you off. We have another piece that originated, Countercurrents, on James Bond that will appear. And we have another piece on Superman that actually went through this process that I'm talking about, where it was actually published at Alternative Right back in 2010, I believe, and it's been kind of rewritten 2.5 years later. And I think that's really good. So we'll have a piece on Superman and Batman, James Bond, Watchmen, which is maybe my favorite all-time graphic novel, and lots of pieces like that. So it's gonna be a really fun issue. And then we're gonna move on from there to this other issue on history and eugenics that I'm working on. That will also have a lot of pieces. And we want to do another issue on collapse and this idea of collapse. So you can kind of see where I'm going. I like this idea of picking really bold themes and open-ended themes and finding some interesting perspectives on these. So in pop culture, history, the history of eugenics, the deep history of eugenics, thinking about eugenics to mankind, and then collapse, what does that mean? So these are kind of what you can expect. I have a lot of ideas. I think Roman wants to do wants to work on some, and he's actually talked to some writers on doing something on Islamophobia, and that might sound a kind of funny thing to say, but basically having a proper view of Islam and not to fall into the kind of Islam baiting of neoconservatives or people like Robert Spencer, but really having a traditionalist view of how we should confront Islam and confront it honestly, but you know, confront it nevertheless. So I think there are really going to be some fascinating stuff. And I think also, as I mentioned before, I think some of these things they'll be on Amazon as books, and people will find them years from now, and they'll be, oh wow, I want to read the whole thing on eugenics or collapse or pop culture or whatever, and I think these will really have a long shelf life. So I'm very excited about Radix, and it's really an adventure, and I think this is something that I can do for many different years, and that will kind of mature into in the sense of really getting to do long, deep pieces on stuff that I've been thinking about for some time.
Well, great, great. So tell us about some of your New Year's resolutions. What are some of the projects you're going to work on this year? What are some of the things you want to do differently? What does 2014 look like, not just for Radix, but for mm-hmm. Richard Spencer, for NPI and for Washington Summit Publishers?
Well, you know, my own personal New Year's resolution was to get better at the little stuff. And, you know, I seem to have a lot of visions and ideas, and I sometimes am slow in executing them and implementing them. And slow, I get overwhelmed by email. I get overwhelmed by putting an index together for a book, and I get overwhelmed by so on and so forth. And I really want to try to get better at the little things. So that was my own personal New Year's resolution. But in terms of stuff we're doing, we're going to do a lot of exciting stuff. First off is just to promote some of the books that we've just published. The last two are Ruben, which is a novel by Tito Perdue, and also Survive the Economic Collapse, which is by Piero San Giorgio, which is a very provocative book, and I think something that a lot of different people are going to want to read. We're also going to publish a new book by Alexander Dugin it's actually a translation from the Russian on Heidegger, and that is being completed. The manuscript is being completed, the translation, as we speak, and so that's going to be exciting. We actually have this book that I'm going to just give a teaser of, because I don't want to fully reveal it yet, but it's a kind of archaeological find. And it is a book that was written by one of the most important people in our movement, and someone who has a lot to do with MPI, that is a kind of undiscovered manuscript. And it is a complete, really well done manuscript. It's ready to be published right now, but it's something people didn't know that he wrote. and we're going to be publishing this. I won't keep it a secret forever. I will let people know what we're doing. And we're doing another book by Raymond Walters on education. And then as we think about almost a year from now, as we go into the fall, in September, we're going to have another conference and all this stuff. So it's going to be a really exciting year. And it's going to be really busy. It's going to be really crazy. But I live for this stuff. So that's just kind of a preview of what we're going to be doing. And there are actually some other little small projects, some new editions of Washington Summit Publishers books, some revised expanded editions, and also another Radix book that we're going to do that's going to be thrown in there. So we're just going to do a lot of good stuff. And I really think that with Roman's help, we can get on track in terms of publishing Radix journals, and that also we're going to publish some really high quality stuff on radixjournal.com. So anyway, it's going to be an energetic, maybe hysteric year.
Did you say historic or hysteric? I'm sorry.
Well, I'll leave that ambiguous. I actually said hysteric in the sense that some of these things are quite stressful. I think you know this as putting on conferences yourself.
Oh, yeah.
There's probably nothing more stressful than putting on a big conference. So I think this will be exciting and maybe a little hysteric in the sense that we really need to execute on some big projects. And it's going to be stressful. We will certainly be attacked as we were throughout 2013. But it's going to be exciting. So I really look forward to it.
Well, Richard, thank you very much. This has been a really great conversation, and I wish you all the best for 2014.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on, Greg. It's a real pleasure.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.